Hey, what's up, sinners and choosers? Welcome to the 3-year anniversary of Choose Your Own Religion. My name is Joe. Thank you so much for tuning in this week. Man, I am so excited to put this episode out this week. I can't believe that it's been 3 years. I actually had to double check and see when exactly I started this because I couldn't quite believe it had been 3 years. But it has been 3 years, and I never would have guessed what this would have led to. Originally, I started this podcast when I was pursuing a full-blown career as a comedian, and I just wanted a long-form place to talk about spirituality and religion and my own experiences, which were complicated, to say the least. And my friend Ryan Middledorf, who was in an improv class with me, was starting his own podcast network, said, "Hey, you should start a podcast." And I said, "Screw it, I guess I'll try." For a while, we were making up a different religion every show, and we made up a lot of pretty cool religions that I wouldn't mind joining myself. And I didn't really know exactly where the whole thing would take me, but I never would have guessed that it eventually led to where I'm at now, which is answering a call to Unitarian Universalist ministry. But that's what's up, and that's what's happening. I just finished visiting 6 different seminaries and divinity schools, figuring out where I'm going to be applying and seeing who is down with me joining their ranks to train me as a minister. And I'm just really filled with excitement and hope and optimism and inspiration and a sense of purpose that I haven't really felt in quite a long time. And I'm still pretty new to Unitarian Universalism. I started going to 2 different churches this year, including one that I'm now, as of this past week, officially a member of, Neighborhood Unitarian Universalist Church here in Pasadena. I also attend Troop Unitarian Universalist Church, also in Pasadena, who I love dearly, and I'm double dipping and probably feeling like a traitor to both congregations, but I feel like it's important for me to get a feel of what 2 different UU churches feel like, since I don't have much experience growing up in this denomination. And to that end, because I still don't know a whole lot about Unitarian Universalism, I thought the perfect guest for this 3-year anniversary, right on the precipice of my ministry, is having the current senior minister at Neighborhood Unitarian Universalist Church, the Reverend Lissa Gunlock. And she is one of the first people I had talks with about my discernment process and made me feel absolutely comfortable and certain that Unitarian Universalism is my spiritual home where I will be of best use for this world. I'm also excited that we are working together to bring the live Choose Your Own Religion show that I've been doing for a while to the Neighborhood Unitarian Universalist Church. And we'll be doing that on January 25th. And if you've never been to one, it's this live show. It's kind of like The Moth, but with singing Alanis Morissette hymns in between and drum circles and all other kinds of fun stuff. But the live shows are a chance for people to tell any story they want about religion or spirituality, whether that's good or bad or funny. I mean, we've had people describe their abuse experiences. We've had people describe their epiphanies, both poignant and irreverent. Really, whatever people want to say. And if you want to tell a story on that, feel free to reach out to me. Best way is to message me on the Facebook page. I love doing these shows because, as I've been doing with this podcast from the beginning, I feel like it's so important for us to be allowed to present our 100% honest and authentic take on spirituality. If we have any prayer of moving forward with it, I think it's really important that everybody is seen and heard for where they're at, even if that's absolutely nowhere. If you hate religion and you want to talk about a specific story of what made you disillusioned, please share that. Or if you love religion, if you want to share what keeps you coming back, you can share that too. And what I think is so cool and important about doing it at a place like Neighborhood UU is that, it speaks to the message and it speaks to the mission that Unitarian Universalists are on, which is not to evangelize or convert people to any specific way of thinking, but to allow us to grow together, starting from the exact starting point that we're at, and maybe hearing more fully where each other is coming from and hearing more about people's direct experiences so that we can continue step by step, story by story, increasing our empathy for each other and figuring out how we can walk each other home in this life. And so I'm so honored to have Lissa on the show today. She's going to help give me her experience of Unitarian Universalism, give a little bit of the history because she knows it far better than I do. It is something that's notoriously hard to describe succinctly. My quick and dirty version is that it's a religion that doesn't require anything you to believe anything. You know, I love how it deals with faith. It's less important what we believe than how we love and how we serve each other and how we live in community with one another and how we orient ourselves to this world. And so it's a religious community of Buddhists and Christians and atheists and agnostics and so many more, and all kinds of combination of all of those that are people that are not committed to evangelizing, but are committed to helping each other on our own individual search for truth and meaning, and respecting the path of whatever path you choose. And once I started learning more about this denomination, I just felt more and more certain that it was home. And I've had some UUs on this podcast before, and that was maybe when my first inklings of maybe this could be a place for me started, but it took a while for that to crystallize. I encourage you to Google Unitarian Universalism and look at their website and see more exactly what UUs believe, but do your own research and look more into Unitarian Universalists, and don't take it just from my word or Lissa's word, but do your own due diligence and see if it's a place for you, if you're even looking for a place at all. But anyway, I wanted to preempt this episode with the second half of a sermon that Lissa recently gave called Verified Faith. I only edited it for time, so you missed maybe some of the initial context of it, but I wanted to make sure the last half of this sermon was in it. It was one that really touched me a lot when I first heard it. And you can find more of her sermons at neighborhooduu.org, including the full version of this sermon. But for now, here is the second half of Verified Faith.
In many traditions, to be a person of faith requires adherence to a creed, a profession of faith, a doctrine, a text, a confession. But primary to our liberal understanding of faith is the idea of choice. We are people who choose our faith, choose what we set our hearts upon, choose the sacred texts and the wisdom which guide our beliefs, and the practices, the causes, and the movements which are worthy of our commitments. But choosing our faith doesn't mean that we aren't aware of the pitfalls of faith. We know there's such a thing as blind faith, faith without wisdom, which can manipulate and exploit human need for meaning. And we know there are steps to be taken in our faith journey, which leads us to make choices to make that faith more real for us. Buddhist teacher Sharon Salzberg describes a first step in faith as having bright faith. She says it's likened to sitting in a darkened room with the door closed, shut in, and alone. Then, for one reason or another, she says the door swings open. We may not see what is on the other side, but there is light. And we know there is possibility on the other side of that door. She said there's a number of things that push open that door. It could be a new love, a friendship, a new choice in your life, inspiration, a new tradition. Bright faith, she says, it's like falling in love. It's that soaring feeling of connection, and you don't want to be away from the person or the object of your faith. But with like love relationships, faith must be experienced as reliable. Reliable in times of crisis and struggle. You must question, doubt, put your faith into practice to truly see with your heart that your faith is worthy to be trusted. That is the next step in faith, which is verified faith. Verified faith. The Buddha said, do not believe anything just because I said it, because a great elder has said it, because you've read it in a sacred text. Put it into practice and see for yourself what is true. Verified faith. Seeing with your heart what is true. See, our heart is a muscle which strengthens with testing. In our faith tradition, we ask you to bring all of your doubt, your concern, your worry, your frustration, your woundedness, to bring all of that in to your faith journey. If you haven't gone through some kind of crisis, If you haven't been disappointed or frustrated or disillusioned, thought of leaving behind the enterprise of religion altogether, if a community hasn't disappointed you or broken your heart or betrayed you, then your heart, that muscle, has not yet been strengthened. Your faith has not yet been verified. When you no longer have illusions that your faith will be perfect, when doubt and question and faith is lost and then found again, your faith finally becomes of use to you. Because friends, I want you to have a faith that you can use, not a faith you're afraid to admit isn't working for you. A seminary professor of mine used to talk about the way that Hebrew traditions over time kept faith. How did these texts and these songs and these traditions make their way from the oral tradition of tribes to be codified in a text? How did people survive exile and oppression, war and genocide? By keeping faith. Texts, he said, were written on the tablets of their hearts, passed by people to generations and generations and generations. This too is how indigenous wisdom has been passed, through harrowing efforts to subdue it, songs passed through generations, from grandmothers to children and children onwards. I loved that Tongo version of Amazing Grace we listened to, and I wondered if you'd looked at the lyrics and how they're slightly different than our lyrics of Amazing Grace. They say, I listen to your name. You helped me. I now see clearly and I am not blind. I want you to look into your own hearts and see if there are words, prayers, songs written there, maybe written by your ancestors, touchstones of faith. Maybe it is Amazing Grace, or the 23rd Psalm. These touchstones which can bring you peace and comfort in times of trial. And just because we don't believe in a creedal tradition doesn't mean we don't need these touchstones for our faith. In fact, perhaps we need them more than ever. So friends, when you look deeply into your hearts today, what is written there? What or whom brings you deep assurance and purpose? What is most sacred and life-sustaining for you in these moments of challenge? Over the coming days, I invite you to name what is sacred to you, to name it out loud, to write it down, to truly be able to see with your hearts clearly. By naming it, you will know how each of you is called to respond in the days ahead. Each of you will have a role. Perhaps you will bring a song. Maybe you will help organize. Maybe you will lead a prayer. We will all lend each other the strength and the courage we need. Just remember that the ancient Pali texts say that faith is not a singular state that we have or do not have, but it's something we do. We faith together. So name those ancestors who stand powerfully beside you, their arms outstretched to strengthen and comfort you. Name what is precious to you, and name this community as a source of life-giving power. May we do faith together, and may we look ahead to the days not with despair, but in an abiding trust in the wisdom of generations who made a way out of no way, not only to survive, but to thrive. Amen, and blessed be.
So what you just heard is a snapshot of why I love Unitarian Universalism and why I love Lyssa, and I love this conversation a whole lot. I do want to address something that perhaps a bad speaking habit I've gotten into when I talk about Christianity. When I say that I couldn't stay in Christianity because I couldn't be intellectually honest, I just want to clarify that that doesn't mean I think Christians are dumb. What I really have been trying to say is that it means I couldn't say the Apostles' Creed or any creed about Jesus and still have my integrity in terms of I'm not really sure about many aspects of Jesus's divinity and relationship to God and whether he rose again from the dead and what miracles he may or may not have performed. I just don't know. I can't honestly say that I do believe them, and I couldn't comfortably affirm that in any kind of church setting. So instead of saying I couldn't be intellectually honest, I should more say I couldn't be authentic and be in a lot of Christian denominations. Even though, in fact, I do consider myself a Christian and a Buddhist and a Taoist and kind of a Hindu and kind of a Sufi Muslim and a lot of other things, and a beautiful heretic to probably all of them. I don't think that any of those people would probably say I'm a very good one of those, but that's kind of what I love about being a UU, is being able to float, combine, and put all these together in my own understanding and have that be totally okay. If you like today's show, you can go to ChooseYourOwnReligion.com for more old episodes and more of that sweet, sweet content. Follow us on Facebook to find out about the next live events. And one last thing before we launch into this, and then I promise I'll be done with the preambles. I hope over the course of the past 3 years and the conversations I've had with people is that you as a listener, wherever you are with religion and spirituality, whether you are a Christian or whether you think religion and spirituality are the most profane possible words, wherever you are is totally fine and understandable, and you deserve feeling the love of the universe and community and a connection to something greater, even if that something greater is just science, you know, quote unquote, just truth, just reason, just learning about all there is to know about the universe. And I hope you are getting that somewhere, whether it's in a religious community or not. And I hope you are feeling fulfilled, and I hope you are feeling happy, and I hope you are feeling great on your path, because we need you at your best. We don't need you to go along to get along. We don't need you to be a people pleaser. We need you to be you. So wherever you are, thank you for listening, and thank you so much for being who you are. Please welcome the Reverend Lyssa Gundlach.
Allow the soothing music and uplifting affirmations to center your heart and mind in an awareness of God's love.
Wake up, my dear sinners. Wake up from your deep rest. Won't you say your prayers? Know that you are blessed. I love you, oh, but Jesus loves you the best. And I hope that you choose your own religion.
You
want to
get started?
Yeah, let's do it.
Cool. We don't have to. I do a formal intro later, so we'll just. Ideally, we would have arrived to this point very organically, instead of this preamble that I just gave.
Totally, I'm just going with the flow.
Right. Great. By the way, thank you for doing this.
Of course.
Invite me to your beautiful office in this beautiful church. So you grew up Unitarian Universalist. Mm-hmm. What is okay? As somebody who's more inundated with, or who's more immersed, I should say. I just want, because I've tried giving people a quick version of Unitarian history. What is your version of like a quick and dirty, like, what is Unitarian Universalism? What is the history? What is Unitarian? What is Universalist? Go.
Got it. Just, you know, starting with a small question.
Right. Yeah. Very easy softball. Yeah.
Totally. So, Unitarianism and Universalism both have Christian origins, and you can kind of look back through Christian history to the very beginning of time, when there were thinkers like Origen who were looking at the dominant paradigms of Christianity and saying, actually, all people should be reconciled with God. Mm. All people should be saved. So you can really look, I mean, that's like, you know, the first and second century. Mm. So those universalist ideas have really been embedded in Christianity for a long time. They've been heretical for the beginning of Christian time. Mm. And the Unitarian ideas too. So they're, you know, you can think about sects of Christian belief where there were questions about the Trinity. Mm-hmm. You know, are there three persons in the Godhead, or is God one? Mm-hmm. And so those questions of both the unity of God and the nature of salvation, and whether, you know, humans can actually be reconciled to mm-hmm. God, can be loved, can be saved. Like, those are fundamental right. questions.
How do I get into heaven?
Yeah. Exactly. Exactly. So that kind of thought has been going for a really long time. You see different pockets of communities developing around those thoughts, that kind of theology, in different parts of the world. So kind of one of the most famous pockets was kind of post-Renaissance in Poland and Transylvania, mm-hmm. Where a lot of folks were flocking for religious freedom from other parts of Europe. And that's actually where the term Unitarian first started in the 16th century. So you had folks who were coming together for these tiny Unitarian communities who really believed in religious tolerance and this thought, again, that God is one.
Right.
And the belief in the Trinity, okay, well, there are, you know, This Christian idea is really important, but we actually think that the God part is actually just one. Mm-hmm. So these little communities here and there, and that also shifted up to Great Britain and then came over to the United States, in different contexts. Mm-hmm. So mostly in the United States context, you really see, congregations, straight from the line of the Pilgrims. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that kind of original settlement
right.
on our American soil in the Northeast. Mm-hmm. And then communities beginning to become more and more liberal. So much so that in the late 1700s, other Christian Protestant congregations started calling them Unitarian. Mm. That their beliefs didn't sound like Trinitarian or mm-hmm. they weren't emphasizing the Trinity at all. So Unitarian was actually, you know, a dirty word.
And in some quarters, it probably still is.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Right. I mean, you know, our beliefs have been kind of heretical from the beginning, and that's no surprise.
Right.
And, you know, quite seriously, I mean, throughout the history of the Reformation, people have actually lost their lives for that belief system.
Yeah.
You can read the history of Calvinism. It's like right there, you know, our people being persecuted. So religious freedom and tolerance has always been like a driving force. And so wherever you see those currents of religious freedom and this call for tolerance, whether it's in different pockets of Europe or different pockets of the United States and definitely the Northeast, you know, mm-hmm. in those, you know, 17th, 18th,
right.
and early 19th centuries, there was a lot of freedom of religion and expression there. As a counterpoint to the Great Awakenings with hellfire and brimstone. Mm. So you really see universalism as a counterpoint to that second and third Great Awakening too, and saying, you know, not everyone is damned and going to hell. Actually, everyone is saved and everyone is loved. Mm. So those are like a tiny little, you know, snapshots.
Right.
The history of Unitarianism and Universalism is totally not linear. So it's mm-hmm. going to be like winding roads and also interesting people. You know,
right.
interesting, charismatic leaders who are, you know, claiming truths and also working with language and developing a sense of a faith tradition mm-hmm. And carrying that forward. And each person carries it a little bit farther.
Right, right.
Including us. You know, we're a part of that too. So that's a part of the history.
Awesome.
And those two denominations merged in 1961. Mm-hmm. when both of them were kind of small. And on the Universalist side, most Protestant denominations had really embraced Universalism.
Right.
That's, you know, whether or not, they actually said so, there was a lot of Universalism being practiced in mainstream Protestantism.
Right.
So that, you know, crew got kind of tiny. And then the Unitarian denomination was really, you know, all about, you know, rational thought, search for truth. And those two ideas fit really well together. Mm-hmm. And actually, as the story goes, their youth groups called for them to join.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah. So the youth groups joined first, and then the adults came along too. So we've been married as a denomination for, you know, since 1961. And you can see different churches still identify with their Unitarian or their Universalist history.
Yeah. And what a great sort of testament to, I love that being part of the origin story is actually children being respected. Or maybe not children. Children might be a strong word for a youth group. But like, you know what I'm saying? Youth being, having a valid voice that isn't just marginalized in lots of church contexts like it often is.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And I was something I also, in my still pretty new encounters with the UU world, I mean, when I was reading through it, I was just kept getting this impression how they always seemed to be on the bleeding edge of stuff and really put themselves out in front of stuff that would later history would kind of end up, in my opinion, proving them right about. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, I think it was 1850s when women were first fully ordained ministers in the Universalist tradition.
Yeah, Olympia Brown.
Olympia Brown, awesome, yeah. And as somebody who grew up with a female pastor at my Presbyterian church, it was, as an associate pastor to my dad, it was always like crazy to me that women wouldn't ever be considered ministers. Like it was always just such an innate, natural part of my life. It was always seemed silly that was ever, and still is a thing in a lot of.
Totally.
Heck, you look at the largest Christian, Catholics a denomination? Are they considered a denomination? Are they their own thing?
I guess so.
I don't know. Anyway. Still, for whatever reason, not hit to women ministers, but and also obviously in the 80s with not just having LGBT ministers, but actually performing gay marriages in the 80s, which is pretty insane when you know what was happening in the 80s. I mean, I wasn't there, but I've read some history. I've read some old newspapers.
Totally, the AIDS crisis and you know affirming the sanctity of marriage between two men or two women, that was incredibly meaningful and important.
Yeah, and it was really brave for their time. And it wasn't totally just, like now, that's almost a part of, shall we say, liberal political religion, is that gay marriage, and I'm glad it is as a liberal, but that wasn't a given even among liberals, that was seen as kind of like, oh, that's too far. That's too much, blah, blah, blah.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. And I mean, during that time too, I mean, the Unitarian Universalist Association really took a stand publicly. And I believe it was one of their employees who actually started one of those lawsuits. And so Massachusetts became, was it the first state to, to have gay marriage as part of the law. And so the UUA was just right in that struggle.
Yeah. And that's, as somebody who's again, new to this world, that's just really exciting to me when I read, you know, a long track record of that kind of leadership and wondering, I think today that what you see at the biggest bleeding edge, one of the edge of that still is LGBT rights, particularly with trans individuals, being more fully accepted and brought into the fold here than I see in most other religious traditions. And I have to think people 50 years from now will be looking back at our times now and being like, man, they were right again. They were right on the forefront. At least that's how I feel about
it. That's what I'm hoping too. And I think, you know, part of what's exciting about our spiritual movement is that we really think that way. We think and we look back into history that way, but also we look to each other and to our movement and to our congregation as this, you know, hope for the future. Mm-hmm. You know, we take our actions seriously and we believe that our actions impact the future.
Right.
So we're writing history.
Yeah. It's, you know, all organizations and institutions are going to be somewhat immovable in their status quo to some degree. There's going to be a lot of inertia in any kind of large institution. But the fact that there has been so much change is really encouraging to me that it's, as somebody wants to be a part of this.
Yeah. You want to jump in.
So I'm curious. I don't know if that was some of the, maybe I'm just front loaded all the reasons, you've been a lifelong UU.
Yeah.
But I know it's also, well, I've read that like 80% of UUs come to it later in life.
Oh, interesting.
Maybe I think that's the latest statistic, but I know in general across all denominations, all churches, people 18 to until they have kids, don't go to church a lot of times.
Right.
And so I'm curious, what was it that kind of, I mean, what is it in your own personal kind of story that made you stick around? And what was your call to ministry like, too? I'm sure they're kind of entwined a little bit.
They are. I mean, I had a call to ministry from a very young age, and it sounds like you kind of did, too.
Well, I resisted it way hard.
Well, I did, too, in my own way. I didn't think that being a minister was very cool.
I'm afraid it's still not, unfortunately.
I mean, it's not very cool, but it also is the coolest. And it's the coolest because, and this is why I've stayed in it. I mean, I was called to ministry at a really young age in high school. And I feel like since then, there have always been these opportunities to minister along the way. And every time I feel like, you know what, it's not worth it, I want to go to a party on Saturday night and, you know, mm-hmm. not get up on a Sunday morning, the conversations that you have with people, the ways that you get to show up for people's lives and to, you know, witness grief and joy and to show up for justice and to marry people and bury people and dedicate children and you create community. Mm. It's just, it's incredible. So that's happened to me since I was in high school and I feel, you know, I did youth ministry and, I participated in what was called the coming of age program, which here is called rites of passage at this church. And that's with young people, 8th graders, 9th graders, getting up in front of the congregation and sharing what they believe. So I wrote a statement of what I believe and read it to the congregation or delivered it. And I had a call to ministry moment of like, I want to be in the pulpit. I want to share with people about what I believe. I want to hear about what they believe because I want to hear that, you know, dialogue. And I want to, you know, be a part of something. And for me, church has always been a second home in some way. You know, church accepted me when I was a youth. You know, my parents got divorced when I was in high school. I came out being gay in college. You know, it's always been a place that accepts me and also where I felt a synergy with others. You know, I felt like my leadership and my identity and my skills and gifts were of use. And I think we have to, you know, bloom where we're planted in some ways. And for me, and whether that's church in general,
right,
or if it's, you know, the denomination that you feel most at home with, and that can be a new place too, because I think that faith catches us at different times in our lives and calls us. And for me, Unitarian Universalism has just like kept calling me. Even when I felt like I just put my fingers in my ears and I was just like, I'm not listening. Like, I'm going to go do my 20s. I'm going to go have fun, go be young. And I've always felt called back, whether that's by a person in the faith community, whether that's by God, whether that's by history calling, you know, like this contemporary moment, which requires our action. I just can't not do it.
Yeah. I love that. It's a slightly more, well, I don't know what kind of question it is, but I've always been curious about this as you know, coming from a comedy background where when I'm bombing, I can feel it. Because it's very obvious when he's like not responding, like, yeah. And it's like, oh, he wanted a punchline. He thought that was a punchline. He expected us to laugh at that. Do you feel it when you're maybe not bombing, but do you ever feel it like when a sermon's like killing it versus not?
Of course. I mean, I think your comedy background is like perfect for. In fact, like I wish I had some more comedic background, and I try to make people laugh or disarm them in some way or just bring them in, whether that's using myself, you know, kind of laughing at myself.
Yeah.
But you can tell when you're really connecting with people. Mm-hmm. I was talking to a comic at a wedding a few months ago, and she and I were relating about the moments of connection you have with people, and it just sort of like cuts through everything.
Yeah.
You know, it's this real heart to heart human moment of just communion.
Yes. Yes.
So you can feel when that happens, and I can feel it inside of me. And that's actually how I feel like God speaks. Mm-hmm. is through those moments.
Yeah.
And when I'm bombing, not like if, but I mean, I feel like my preaching has come a long way, and I feel proud of where I'm at right now. And most of that is because of a relationship with the congregation.
Yeah.
And it just takes a long time to get to know people, but also to figure out how you want to share yourself.
Yeah.
And I figured that out sort of learning from what works and doesn't work.
Yeah.
But a lot of times when I feel disconnected, it's when I feel like I'm not grounded or I'm not sure about what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's almost like, you know, that's a message from God too, of just like, you know, reconnect here, you know, like you can't be a channel for, you know, whatever you're trying to communicate. Values, beliefs, storytelling, you know, your own personal experience, you know, trying to lift up the real issues that affect people's lives.
Yeah.
You know, you need to be connected to be able to do that. And that's connection to spirit.
Mm. Man, you're really speaking my language right now. And by the way, you are an excellent minister. I'm not just saying that. You're a great minister. I've loved a lot of your sermons. I think that's, that connection of what you're talking about, it's not limited to just the medium, as you were describing with your friend with the comic. And it's not even just limited to public speaking either. I think we feel that connection with any great work of art, really. Not great, maybe be a strong word, a good work of art. When you just feel like it's a total empathetic connection that is truth revealing.
Yeah.
And comedy can be so fun because it happens in an instant and you're not expecting it to happen, and that's what makes you laugh, right? Is that surprise.
Yeah.
And that total, I mean, yeah, I think the inherent aspects of when I've struggled on stage has been definitely when I've not been sure of what I'm saying. And I think that made comedy about religion very hard for me for a long time.
Right.
Or just comedy in general, where I had to be like very judgmental. And what's weird is that I don't judge comedians for being judgmental when I'm like watching comedy. I enjoy watching comedy still like anybody else, but I found it difficult to perform when in my own head I could play the devil's advocate for like the other point of view for something, which is like, not great comedy to be like, well, let's just think about how they would have seen it. You know, like, and the
right.
Empathy you is really not have the to like
double ways. Down.
Right.
Right.
But it did make me, I think, when I discovered storytelling, I think that did make me an effective storyteller, is that storytelling to me is so great because I don't have to limit myself to a certain emotional range that usually is more conducive to comedy, like, you know, certain types of anger or joy or like sarcasm. Those are all like great for stand-up purposes, but like letting yourself actually sit in sadness is very rare. And I'm not gonna say it's impossible, but let's take even like, did you see Hannah Gadsby's Nanette? Excellent, excellent. But some people would, I mean, there were a lot of people online who's like, that's not really comedy. And then I think it is almost more storytelling the way she was doing it than pure stand-up,
right?
Too. Which I love, by the way. It's not a criticism. It's just a different medium. All that to say is that own confidence, which I've never really thought about it in that mm-hmm. spiritual sense of maybe this is God, this is something greater than me, channeling that I'm like channeling in these right moments, that I found something that is confident. I'm confident enough that this is the truth, that I can feel that way.
Mm-hmm.
But well, this is where I get nervous, though, is that I know I argue with people who also feel that sense of truth, and they're I think they're completely wrong sometimes about stuff. And I'm like, well, we can't both be feeling God, can we?
Maybe what I'm not talking about is the truth piece that's God.
Yeah, that
it's
was
actually
all me.
You know, but I think, you know, it's like whether you're playing a piece of music or playing sports, you know, even like last night, like unfortunately I felt like the Red Sox had it more than the Dodgers did. But you just see this this ease and this life force that is both with you and going through you. And so, you know, you can call that God or spirit or energy or, and I think it does build with confidence, you know, doing it enough times. It's about trusting yourself to actually let that be free. And so it's not actually about the truth at all, but about the freedom and the confidence to let those thoughts move through you and to touch others.
Sure. Yeah, that makes sense.
And it's also like a conversation, you know? A sermon's maybe different than comedy in some ways because you want people to have ideas of their own about it, you know? You want people to bring a passionate stance, even though it can be kind of like, well, can't you just, you know, accept that? Like, I just prepared that. Like, now do we have to talk about it? But, you know, it's supposed to be provocative in some ways.
Sure. I guess this is kind of related. What do you do for your own spiritual practices when you're not being... Do you have spiritual practices? Do you get spiritually fed entirely through your work as a minister? Or do you go to places... Like, I have a minister friend I was just visiting with in Boston who occasionally goes to this church that's older than America... know, literally 400 years old, Old South Church. And she says, she's a minister at a Presbyterian congregation there, but she says, I want to be like the worst congregant at another place and just like, just show up, sit in the back, not talk to anybody, but that's what I need out of like some, cause she gets so much, she gives so much in her other church context. And I imagine it must be tough for you because you're constantly giving in your role as the leader of this community.
Yeah, I think that's a real challenge for religious leaders, and you'll discover it for yourself if that's, you know, what you step into. Your work does feed you a lot, and it's also like a feedback loop that's really it's like perpetuatingly exciting. You know, you email people and you visit people, and you're constantly getting a lot from it. You know. But when my practice is really to have silence and disconnection, because a lot of my self-worth as a minister is tied up in responding and being available. And so I have to be available for silence, and I have to be available for spirit, and I have to be available for nature and to really tune into a different way of being. And so, you know, my practice is actually to create absence and, in order for newness to come in, because I can just get caught up in, you know, going, and you really need to dip down into the depths. And that can be a very uncomfortable place.
Right.
You know, you had a question on there about motherhood too. And it's like, motherhood is like constantly being on. And so, you know, my challenge is to continually carve out time for my own reflection and doing those practices of prayer or nature walks or you know, just grooving with music that is like my own and isn't like Sesame Street, you know? spiritual music, you know, you're a fish guy, like right. whatever, like lets you just wander. And I think that wandering is like the most luxurious place for me, both spiritually and emotionally too.
Yeah. I love that. Yeah, I mean, it's like, how can we help, well, in your case, this is your job, this is what I would like to do, but how can we help people access the transcendent if we don't access that ourselves?
Exactly.
And I totally, yeah, silence as being one of the most transcendent things. That's one of the quickest ways I definitely plug in, or unplug. But
unplug, plug in.
Unplug
yeah.
to plug in.
To plug in, yeah.
For sure. And sometimes it's not always silence for me too. I mean, this is why I think when I think of the things that have inspired my call, well, first they were the things that maybe had me feeling more of a call in high school towards ministry in general. When I did youth leadership stuff, working at various church camps as like a high schooler for like middle school conferences, which kind of seems insane now in retrospect. We have high schoolers like leading right. middle schoolers to
right.
God.
Yeah.
The slightly less blind right. leading the blind. But we were really enthused, and like, this is in Virginia and at Massanutten Springs. And it was honestly the 2 weeks that we would spend every summer, like me and my high school crew, was like, there's just like the most like, utopic experiences of your life, because we were just so like purely for each other and mm-hmm. for God, and just in this total loving headspace. We're like, oh, humans could like, if we could just communicate this feeling,
yeah,
we could all be a-okay. And I'd lost a little bit of that, and this is what I think, this is why I have really come to appreciate Unitarian Universalism in particular, is that the reason I lost that strand of me was because one way or the other, I felt like I couldn't intellectually, honestly call myself a Christian in the context I was raised. By the way, I've since learned that my dad in particular, like the stuff they learned in seminary is the stuff I learned in undergrad about like the Bible and how it was written that made me stop being a Christian.
Right. Right.
But I was never
liberal
like,
interpretation.
Right. But yeah. I was never like raised with like the, like, oh yeah, the Bible was probably written by like four different, like the first five books were probably written by four different sources. Probably not literally Moses. Probably, you know, maybe this didn't happen and that's okay, 'cause it still teaches us a nice story. You know,
right.
It's still a good lesson. I don't remember getting that very much. And I feel so much freedom to be able to do that in this world,
yeah.
In the UU world. And as a leader too, I think you could probably even get away with, I know you can. I mean, my dad talks to me about this all the time, that there's people in his congregations that are like somewhere on that seeking path that are also not, you know, totally, they may not literally believe every word of the creed, the right. Apostles' Creed that they say every week, but I don't feel like I could do that as a leader very easily. that makes me nervous.
Mm-hmm.
Who's going to be like
right.
calling me out or watching my back. I have not felt that at all in this world.
Right. No, we don't have that kind of need to affirm the creeds or a doctrine belief.
Right.
Which is freeing in some ways. And then it's also a lot of responsibility to construct a durable theology that then you share with others and
mm-hmm.
invite people into,
mm-hmm.
you know, to be really disciplined and systematic about it
mm-hmm.
In a liberal context.
Yeah.
So it's its own challenge, but there's a lot of freedom. There's a lot of freedom to also change. And
mm-hmm.
I think that's one of the reasons I've stuck with Unitarian Universalism, is because you can grow and change. You don't have to have the same faith your whole life.
Right.
And it can mean different things. You can bring in new sources, have a life event, a transition,
mm-hmm.
you know, a loss, and your perspective changes, your faith changes.
Yeah.
And so you can bring those questions and, you know, birth your faith anew for every new life experience that you have.
Right. I mean, it sounds like a joke, but I don't mean it as a joke. But, like, I could decide to be a pagan next year and be a Unitarian, you know?
You could.
There's a lot of... They had a... I didn't go to it. I wanted to.
Yeah.
But they had a pagan worship service.
They did.
For Halloween's past weekend.
Which is the high holy day for the pagans.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But anyway, what I was trying to say was, like, so... I think when I feel called to ministry, it's when I feel so emotionally moved and resonated, like that time in my little Virginia camp.
Yeah.
I also do get it in those meditative moments when I don't feel as emotionally activated, but I feel that silence. I feel that connection to an incredible...
Something.
an incredible emptiness.
Yes.
You know, and truly the word incredible... as what that word means. But I think what's the challenge of all religions, I would argue, is that because so many of us come to God in so many different ways, Christians have their own forms for it, depending on which Christian educator you ask. Hindus, I know some Hindus describe the four yogas of I'm not going to even pretend that I know the names of the four yogas, but basically, you know, the path of service, of volunteerism, you might say, the path of this emptiness, the sort of meditative path, the ecstatic devotion of love, and that emotional path,
bhakti,
right? And the more intellectual sort of theologian type path, for lack of a better word. And it's just so hard to get all of those in one religion. And I think at best you can kind of maybe keep people kind of in the same roof and offer ways for people to engage all those different things. But it's hard because we're humans and we tend to cluster together. And
right.
So maybe you get your, like, I feel like Presbyterians are a pretty heady group, more intellectual style, a lot of doctors and lawyers, good seminaries.
Right.
But there's not a whole lot of ecstatic dancers in the Presbyterian world, shall we say. Which I kind of feel a little bit in the Unitarian world, but that's fine. That's all to say that I feel like I need to be... I'm in a weird place where the intellectual honesty and framework is important to me enough to where it can be a deal breaker. It's not always a deal breaker for some people. Some people can go to a church and be like, I don't need to really believe what their doctrine says.
Right.
And that's okay.
Yes.
But because I get to dance or whatever it is, you know?
Right.
So anyway, yeah, that's my challenge as a future leader is I don't know if I'll be totally fed, doing the leadership myself, but I guess that's a totally okay thing.
Yeah. Well, you'll discover that. And I think a lot of ministers describe really loving to create the art of a worship experience or to create that meditative place for people and to invite people into that. And that actually becomes a lot of your own practice.
Yeah.
So I'm just curious about how it shows up in you and, you know, where you feel excited to serve and develop your ideas. And, you know, there's a lot to explore.
I
don't think you should be afraid of it. You know, I think you're somebody who has a really strong sense of a path and a seeker instinct that you're going to keep seeking out those experiences.
Yeah.
And you're going to start to kind of separate a little bit, you know, what are the experiences that bring me deeper or bring me a new kind of awareness and consciousness about questions of transcendence and spirit and connection. And then, you know, what are my leadership characteristics that I'm building? Both, you know, my ability to communicate with a sermon, my ability to create a liturgy that holds people, my ability to be able to motivate people to live lives of integrity and service.
Yeah.
So those are different questions, and kind of now they're all on the horizontal plane, and they'll start to like settle in their places a little bit.
For sure. So that's, I mean, that definitely speaks to, I guess, feels like it speaks to me as a future potential leader. I'm curious because what would you say to somebody who says like, well, I like the idea of religious pluralism. I like the idea of being able to live with, in a religious community with Buddhists and Muslims. Or, I mean, I know a lot of people of faith are already basically there in their minds where they worship in their church, and they're like, oh yeah, so-and-so are cool with me. What do you see of like the pros or cons of like, let's say like of somebody who's like, I'm definitely a Christian. That is definitely my path. Should I go to a Unitarian church or not? Is that a place for me? Or is it better that I just stay in my own tradition and just wave at the Unitarians across the road?
Right. Well, yesterday in our services, I went up to a newcomer before service and he said, now, I hope it's okay that I'm here. I'm a Muslim, mm-hmm. and I'm looking to move to the area, and I want to have a place to pray where I can walk. Mm. And I'm looking at this area to buy a house. I hope it's okay that I'm here. And I wasn't clear if he thought what he thought the church was. And mm-hmm. maybe some people don't know what they're getting into.
Right.
You know, the signs on our street could be clearer about what exactly the church is.
Right.
But he was looking for a supportive community which had a place for him to pray and to contemplate and to be with other people. And so I think that was really interesting of someone who is seeking a community where they could practice their beliefs safely, mm-hmm. And to have a conversation about faith and belief and life with other people who are thinking about similar questions,
yeah.
and perhaps coming from different standpoints. I have a new member who has a Buddhist orientation, and she said, what did she say to me? She was talking about loving kindness and practicing loving kindness and how difficult that is, mm-hmm. and how she appreciated our sermons in helping her to understand more about how to actually practice loving kindness and to live it. So I think people often are coming from different, very well-formed traditions. Perhaps where the teachings are being communicated in kind of a, what I would call a pure form, mm-hmm. like looking at the scriptures and interpreting the scriptures, but people want more of an application or like a practical application for their lives.
Yeah.
So maybe they're getting the teachings from other places, but then they actually want to know how to live life mm-hmm. in a diverse community in the Trump era. In an interfaith context where, you know, Muslims and Jews are being attacked, in a diverse community where LGBT people are, their rights are under threat. So they want to be able to bring the world into their religious space as well.
Yes.
And yes. not to have the text so purely interpreted that there's no space to actually be a person.
Right. Yeah. And I can only speak to my own point of view of what drew me to this, this denomination. But, you know, even as earlier as this year, I was discerning, whether my ministry would go back into the Christian form or in this denomination. And something I just kept coming back to was this idea that, something a mentor of mine said, I don't want to publicly say who he is because he might get in trouble. I'm sure he probably wouldn't care, but out of respect, I'll keep him anonymous. This is a Christian pastor who believes that Christianity, basically going forward, needs to be permeable to other religions in a way that it hasn't been. And not just, I think, even beyond the current good, better than it was interfaith model of, again, like, we'll come together for specific things, maybe to work on something together,
right.
but we don't. And we, in theory, I guess, respect each other that we have different beliefs, but we don't really see how our beliefs could possibly be reconciled.
Right.
Whereas for me, I want to push that further. I want to say, like, actually, I think our theologies could have a lot more in common, but that's because I'm like, so geeked out anytime I could talk about like mysticism or anything like that.
Right.
You know?
Right. Well, I mean, I think one of the coolest things about Unitarian Universalism is that we actually believe that encountering another person's faith teaches us more about our own. Mm. And that you discover more about the truth. You discover more about who God is or isn't by being curious about another person's experience of those religious questions. Mm-hmm. So you're constantly in this discovery. And so I think that's really the common, you know, where you're kind of looking for that common ground or common landscape of interfaith or pluralistic culture, is that space of like genuine sharing, which enhances and enriches your belief. Yeah. And opens each person to being changed, mm-hmm. right? To having mm-hmm. their experience of belief be interpreted differently because of another person's story, whether that's, wow, I really can't have this, you know, very strict belief about LGBT people after meeting this person. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, if it's about a teaching that really changes your perspective that you hadn't heard before. Mm-hmm. So I think that kind of sharing across cultures and faiths is incredibly important, and it's a part of our UU practice. But we need to put ourselves in those circumstances to be right. able to receive and be in that dialogue, mm-hmm. which is actually one of the cool things about going to seminary, which I think you're going to love.
Yeah. I'm excited about that too. Even that, though, I mean, I'm looking at a mix of, it's like 50-50, explicitly multi-religious, seminaries that don't have a favorite institutionally versus some that are, you know, explicitly and unapologetically Christian.
Right.
Still fine with having Unitarians be there, but they're also like, no, we are a Christian institution. But I even think there's something I can learn from that.
Yeah, absolutely. You know? Absolutely.
And hopefully they can learn from me a little bit. Maybe.
Absolutely. I agree.
I guess to wrap up. So you mentioned briefly a couple of things that Unitarians, I guess, believe about belief a little bit, uh-huh. or about sharing these beliefs. What sure. is, but famously, well, famously as Unitarians get, I suppose, there's no creed in Unitarian Universalism. There's no thing you quote unquote have to believe.
Right.
That being said, what is it that Unitarians believe?
Well, I wanted to read this really great quote from Thomas Starr King, who was one of our founders in California. Universalists believe that God is too good to damn people. And the Unitarians believe that people are too good to be damned by God.
I love that.
Yeah. Yeah. So God is too good to damn people. So everyone is loved. Everyone is saved. Everyone is worthy. No one is excluded from God's love or from our human covenant. And that's about tolerance, you know, respecting the inherent worth and dignity of every person, about that connection across difference, mm-hmm. and disagreement. And then the Unitarians believing that people are too good to be damned by God. That's the belief that humans can make a difference, that justice is possible, that famous line that MLK and Obama borrowed from Theodore Parker, that the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice. Mm. So that, you know, our human history is built on a series of, you know, humans progressing towards the good. And we interpret the good as more tolerance, more justice making, and that's, you know, connected to real concrete actions in this lifetime, but this sense that history is long and that we're in this for the long haul, so, and also that, you know, human beings are fundamentally good, and that's a really hard belief too.
Yeah.
You know, that we do believe that evil was real and that people's actions really do a disservice to that sense of inherent worth. And, you know, that this world has incredible evil that needs to be met with a good and a love that is even more intense and powerful. And we believe that love wins.
Right on. Man, I could just even in that statement alone, I just want to jump off on the 30 more threads, but unfortunately we don't have time.
Hopefully we'll talk again.
I would love that.
Yeah.
Thanks for doing this.
Yeah, of course.
And once again, just thanks for having me and welcoming me to your congregation. Yeah. And all the off mic seminary input totally. You've given me too. I really of appreciate course. It.
No problem. Thanks. Thank you.
And that is our show. Thank you so much to the Reverend Gunlock for coming over. ChooseYourOwnReligion.com for old episodes. January 25th at Neighborhood Unitarian Universalist Church in Pasadena. Come out to the next live Choose Your Own Religion. It'll be a night of storytelling and music and dumb bits. Not taking any of this too seriously, but just the right amount of seriously. Thank you for listening. Thank you for 3 years. Thank you for being who you are. Namaste.